Just as this figure in the picture repeats itself on a smaller and smaller scale, so the principle of the living being repeats itself again and again on a smaller scale in the organism of every living being. So there are beings within beings, and organisms within organisms. As these organs are living beings or life units, they too consist of an eye and a combination of bodies that, like the main figure, is shown by a white, round figure with a triangle and a dark ring round it, within which we again find eight figures of the same kind as the main figure, only smaller. This means that the organs, when considered as living beings, are also equipped with organs that are in turn to be expressed as living beings. As these latter organs are thus living beings too, they are also equipped with organs that again are to be expressed as living beings. We can continue in this way without ever reaching an end or the cessation of life. Life in reality consists exclusively of living beings. Everything is life. But since this immeasurable host of living beings spans an infinite panorama of evolution, the same beings reciprocally come to represent a correspondingly infinite variety in their very manifestation or appearance. It is this variety that is the absolute determining basis for the same being's existence or experience of life. It is precisely this variety that determines that the living beings each, in the form of the experience of their own lives, can be organs for other living beings, thereby promoting life for one another. But how could they fulfill their mission if they were exactly the same, living in the same dimensions or of exactly the same size? How could our lungs be lungs for us, or our kidneys, cells, molecules, atoms, electrons and so on be serviceable as material for our physical body and manifestation if they were human beings or living beings of the same category as we are? Such an eventuality would be the opposite of that which is a fact, namely, life. And a real death or an absolute nothing would thereby prevail. The universe with its galaxies, suns, planets, continents, oceans, spheres and planes of existence, and other manifestations of the Eternal Father, would never have been perceived by the brain of a living being, for such a brain would exist just as little as all these realities would. But exactly the same would be the case if our organs, cells, molecules and so on, or everything that belongs to the term substance or matter, were not identical to living beings. If the substance were not a combination of life units, it would never be able to represent vibration or movement. A lifeless thing absolutely cannot bring about any movement whatsoever. Here you may object that in daily life we see many dead things move themselves. We see the clouds moving across the sky, we see the water roaring in rivers and streams, we experience the noisy breakers of the ocean, just as we have also become familiar with the course of the planets and stars amongst each other. But are all these realities now dead things too? No. It is naturally only in the primitive or spiritually unenlightened human beings' imagination that they are perceived as dead and, as such, are expressed as the forces of nature. But the truth is that all these movements, or the collective macrocosmos, are also expressions of living beings or life units. Just as our organs, cells and other bodily material are life units within us, so are we ourselves organs within a greater being's organism. This greater being is the earth. The earth is also a life unit with an eye and a physical body. The physical earth is thus the physical body of this life unit. The earth constitutes in turn an organ in the solar system, which is also a life unit, whose physical body is made up of its physical solar body with the planets belonging to it. The solar system is in turn an organ in the galaxy, which in the same way also appears as a life unit with an eye and a physical body. This being, or gigantic life unit, is in turn an organ in an even greater system or being, and so on continuously into infinity. So no living beings can exist without being organs in a larger being, just as they themselves equally cannot exist without being built up of an ocean of smaller beings or life units. By virtue of this, the symbol can be used to express the principle of life of any living being whatsoever. If we imagine the smallest circles on the picture, those that are almost invisible to the naked eye, as expressions of the life units that appear as people. The larger circles in which they appear would signify beings of the order of the earth. The larger circles in which the circles of these latter beings appear will then signify beings of the order of the sun or the solar system, while the circles of the next size are to be regarded as signifying the galaxy beings. These circles are made up of the eight largest figures of the main figure. The symbol as a whole thus in this case signifies a being so large or a life unit so gigantic that our galaxy constitutes merely a single organ in it. If we imagine the symbol as a whole signifying a human being, the eight largest round figures in the ring, as already stated, will signify its organs, while the figures of the next size signify its cell beings. The circles of the ensuing sizes will then signify its so-called substance or matter. And here we come down to the regions of life units that are to be found in our food and drink. Chapter 18 Inner and Outer Conditions for the Life Units or Microbeings in Our Organism as Well as for Ourselves. Just as the life units we call human beings, animals and plants, in order to manifest themselves or maintain life, require certain inner as well as outer conditions, so the small life units that appear for us in the form of substance or our intake of food, drink, tobacco and so on also require inner and outer conditions for their perfect existence. For people, animals and plants the outer conditions consist of the universe, the natural surroundings in which they live, which in turn means the planet on which they are situated, the forces of nature surrounding them, the climate, the spiritual atmosphere or all the realities that together constitute the organism in which the mentioned beings experience life. The inner conditions for the same beings will on the other hand be the harmony between the life units that, in the form of organs, cells, molecules and so on, experience life in their bodies, together with the introduction of the right life units or living beings that, in the form of substance or matter, should be material for the maintenance of the same bodies. For the life units in our intake the outer conditions are likewise the universe, the forces of nature, the spiritual atmosphere or all the realities together constituting the organisms within which they live, with the one difference that, while for people these realities are the ordinary known universe, the known forces of nature and their religious or cultural standard respectively, the universe for the above mentioned small beings consists of the bodies of the people, animals and plants in which they are situated. The circulation of the blood, the digestion and the oxidation that take place in the body in question will thus be the forces of nature for the small beings, while the cultural standard for these beings is determined by the level of evolution to which the organisms in which they are situated belong, which in turn means whether these organisms are plants, animals or people. The inner conditions for the small beings or life units in our intake are naturally also that they get the proper nourishment, the proper surroundings, but these affect us only in such cases where we, in the form of food and drink, have introduced some of the same life units into our organism that do not belong there and therefore cannot get their vital conditions fulfilled in this, but achieve an unnatural, sick and deadly existence. Through the introduction of such life units into our organism disharmonies arise in it, disharmonies that can sometimes be so intense that they ultimately make this totally unsuited as a universe or residence for the life units that in reality belong there, whereby this must therefore perish in an unnatural way. These disharmonies are identical to the fatal organic illnesses that occur in daily life. For the human being it is thus of great importance to introduce, in the form of food, the proper life units into his organism or physical body. Chapter 19 As the life unit constitutes matter's primordial substance the universe becomes identical to a notion of eternal life. Through the symbol just described we have gained insight into the living being's principle of life and have, through its analysis, come to the finest, absolute definition of what the matter or substance in existence can be divided into, namely the life unit. Life units are thus the basic analysis of any substance whatsoever. They are the highest division into fine particles of all matter and so constitute existence's absolutely only primordial substance. but as this primordial substance, in the form of living beings or independent particles of life itself or the living in the universe, constitutes the creating basis of everything that can be manifested and sensed in microcosmos as well as in macrocosmos. The identity of the universe as an all-embracing ocean of life is, through the principle of life units, guaranteed as an eternal, unchangeable fact. It is this fact that is revealed in every form of movement, in every form of transformation, in every form of creation. It is upon this fact that the tooth of time, as well as the decomposition process of corpses, is based. If the substance were not life, an eternal stillness would be the true fundamental analysis of the universe. No movement whatsoever would be possible. But without movement there can be no manifestation, and without manifestation the universe would be identical to an eternal, absolute death. An eternal nothing would have replaced the life now existing, the life that, as a fact, in the form of life units or living beings, sparkles and radiates, identical to all things, the life in which all things live, move and have their being. Chapter 20. When living things are regarded as dead, as all living beings in the form of life units are substance, and all substance in the form of life units is living beings, an absolute lifelessness would thus be an impossibility in the universe. But as lifelessness is an impossibility, absolutely dead things will also be an impossibility. But when dead things are an impossibility, disharmony will certainly arise in such fields where an individual regards living things as dead, and of necessity treats them accordingly. It is this abnormality that to a far too great extent holds true in the fields where the terrestrial human being deals with substance or matter, and particularly where he has to choose the substances for his nourishment and the maintenance of his organism. And on the basis of this illusion he comes to sin or act wrongly against himself as well as against the small beings or life units in the substances or its intake of food, drink and so on. I will therefore later point out the matter or the substances consisting of life units that to a particular degree suit the human organism, that is to a particular degree achieve, not a mutilating or deadly, but a perfect or natural existence by being consumed as nourishment in the above-mentioned organism, whereby there arises for the human being concerned an unmistakable way out of the dark barbarism of heathendom or the traditions of killing in the area of nutrition, which, through the present book, have been shown to constitute the most profound cause of the opposite of all absolute heath or of the joy and happiness that must of necessity be among the basic pillars in a sustained peace on earth. Chapter 21. The intrinsic vibration of the living being and the intrinsic vibration of substance. We have now come so far in the analysis of matter that we have reached recognition of the fact that this matter or the substances are life or signify the manifestation of living beings. They each signify a particular kind of energy or vibration. Gold, silver, copper, iron and all metals each has its own particular vibration, just as meat, blood, juices, acids, sugar, salt, fruit, roots, kernels, leaves, stalks and so on each have theirs. As the human being, by virtue of his identity as a life unit, also constitutes a particle of a substance made up of all terrestrial human beings together, this substance has naturally its particular kind of vibration too. This kind of vibration is so close to us that we are here not physically excluded from seeing its details, as we are with the vibrations of ordinary substances. One sees these in all their particulars. The details in the kind of vibration that is emitted from the substance in which people are life units comprise all the things and traditions created by the human consciousness, such as houses, bridges, dams, engines, works of art, clothing and jewelry, as well as unions, sects, cultures, fashions, manners, customs and so on. All these realities express various strong, and less strong, vibrations, together of necessity representing a particular standard of force, which in turn means a particular unit of measure of energy or vibration. This unit of measure constitutes substance for a sufficiently superior layer of consciousness, for example such as belongs to globe or planet beings. For the terrestrial human being himself, it does not, of course, constitute substance. He has to go just as far down in the ladder of evolution beneath him as he himself is under the planet being's place on the same ladder before he begins to regard things as substance. In this connection, it may be pointed out that the substance that is made up of the collected manifestation of terrestrial mankind, and in which the human being is a life unit, is the cerebral matter of the earth. The world cultures with their religions that pass over the planet are the workings of the earth's brain, are the earth's thoughts. These cultures are the amounts of energy through which it forms its influence on its fellow beings, that is other planet beings, other globes. But here we are at the limit of the cosmic sight within the reach of the human being. We cannot sense what the earth tells one of its fellow being or another planet, since the prerequisite for this is based on that part of evolution by which the earth is ahead of us and which we as yet have not traveled. We can just manage faintly to discern its messages so much that we can see if they are evil or good. We can thus feel if they are hot-tempered. World wars are thus outbursts of anger by the earth. But to which planet, to which fellow being of the earth the amounts of energy of such outbursts are directed is quite another topic. I will therefore not go into further detail about this here. When I have ventured into the present problem, it is in order to show how the small beings are dependent on the large, and the large dependent on the small. Just as the earth during its outburst of anger in 1914-18 suffered terribly, got many of its brain cells, people, killed, others mutilated, or, in brief, had large parts of its cerebral matter, terrestrial human society, destroyed or deranged, so too does a human being derange large parts of his cerebral matter through his fits of temper. Here many of the life units in his brain are likewise killed or mutilated. As the brain is normally the seat of physical vital function, this function is necessarily to a corresponding degree undermined by every fit of temper. This in turn results in disharmonies in the experience of life itself for the individual concerned. It can even poison the blood. So we see through this that a certain interplay is prompted between the substance and the individual using the substance as material for his manifestation. This in turn means between the intrinsic vibration of the substance and the intrinsic vibration of the individual. During an outburst of anger, these two vibrations collide with one another and disharmony arises. These kinds of vibration do not harmonize with each other. So every living being has to do with two general forms of vibration, its own intrinsic vibration and the intrinsic vibration of the substance. To create and make use of one's manifestation on the basis of the harmony between these two kinds of vibration is the highest goal on every plane of existence. To live in this harmony is the culmination of happiness in each of existence's six general forms of experience of life. See Livetsbog. We have with this come through the most difficult analyses connected with the ideal food. For some readers they have perhaps been just as boring as they have been difficult. But for those who have had sufficient energy and interest to study these and have thereby got the correct view of the problems, this view will now give them access to understanding the substantiation of the following analyses of the ideal food to such a degree that these analyses will be science or facts for the same beings. Chapter 22 Total Lack of Moral Insight into the Individual's Relationship to the Myriads of Beings that Constitute its Substance. The above analysis will thus mean that every living being, by virtue of its manifestation, by virtue of everything that it produces, but chiefly by virtue of its particular bodily standard, represents a particular collective energy or type of vibration. On this type of vibration depends its entire experience of life, its feeling of pleasantness and unpleasantness. This is its instrument for the maintenance of its identity and place in existence as a living being. This maintenance is thus based on a certain way of overcoming other forms of energy. If this overcoming, in addition to meaning harmony and happiness for itself, also means harmony and happiness for the source of these other energies, its own experience of life will be the culmination of harmony with the laws of life. But if this overcoming means death and mutilation for the source of these energies, its own experience of life will be correspondingly identical with mutilation, suffering, and pain, or what we call a dark fate. The individual's entire formation of fate is thus based on this interplay between its own energy or vibration and the vibration or unfolding of energy of its surroundings. That this holds true for that part of the individual's surroundings that are to be expressed as its fellow human beings and other forms of living beings having a size that is physically visible is common knowledge and is stimulated through religions and faith and is thus the basis for its morality. What is not common knowledge, however, or not included in the terrestrial human being's morality, but which will now gradually begin to hold true in the New World culture's view of humanity, is the individual's interaction with that part of its surroundings which is regarded as substance, a part of which it has to use as food or nourishment. Through the analysis of the life unit, we have seen here that the source of the substance is also living beings, but of microscopic dimensions. This in turn means that the individual is here faced with a host of living beings with whose unfolding of energy it must also interact. If this interaction, as previously mentioned, means life and devolution, not only for the individual itself but also for the substance beings, then its experience of life reaches a peak of health and its ensuing well-being. It becomes absolutely free of illness. But if the interaction means killing and mutilating for the substance beings, it will elicit returning forces that will mean ill health and illness for the organism and thereby the undermining of the individual's mental functions. Chapter 23: Why vegetarian food is a healthier source of nutrition than animal food. In accordance with the above, one will in the New World culture go more and more into the question of the ideal food. As all the substances and materials with which we must of necessity come into contact are alive, and as we, by our cooperation with these substances, can inflict suffering and pain upon these life units or give them a natural evolution and happiness in the same way as we, by our cooperation with the otherwise recognized, physically visible living beings or fellow beings, can inflict suffering upon them or bring them happiness, I will here point out the substances whose life units attain a natural evolution as nourishment in the human organism, and those whose life units attain an unnatural evolution through the same process. As I mentioned previously, vegetarian food constitutes a state of vibration which, by its nature, is adapted to the human organism's own vibration, while animal food, with the exception of milk, constitutes a state of vibration which is too close in evolution to the human's own vibration. This in turn means that between the life units of the vegetarian food and the life unit that is made up of the whole human being or individual, there is a suitable distance in evolution. The intrinsic vibration of this individual is thereby sufficiently superior to the vegetarian state of vibration. So there will be no particular unnatural resistance for the human organism to overcome when converting the correct vegetarian products into nourishment. It is quite a different matter with animal food, whose life units have come further on the ladder of evolution and are therefore closer to the human being's identity as a life unit. As a consequence of this, these foodstuffs or substances represent a correspondingly stronger or coarser state of vibration than the vegetarian sources of nourishment. Since the human organism, as a result of its development, has reached so far that it is adapted or attuned to the vegetarian state of vibration, a state of vibration that is coarser or relatively stronger than this will come to constitute a resistance to the human organism. The same organism has in reality grown away from the level of the beast of prey and does not have an organism that, like this being's, is built for the release of such a strong state of vibration that animal food does not constitute an unnatural resistance. But let me say in this connection that even if the animal food suits the beast of prey, this does not, all the same, prevent the life units in the same food experiencing being killed and mutilated when being absorbed as nourishment into the organism of the animal in question. but it is precisely this circumstance that constitutes one of the great factors making the zone of the beast of prey a lower plane of existence, an imperfect experience of life. And to the same extent as the human being represents the same level, he too is also an expression of imperfection. For the human being, animal food is therefore too resistant. This in turn causes the human being, in order to digest this food, to use a reserve of strength that he in reality, because of his development, is neither mentally nor physically any longer able to use without risk to health or the existence normal to his step in evolution. And it is the reaction of the production of this perpetual reserve of strength, this permanent overburdening of the organism that, as mentioned previously, is the basis of all organic illnesses. It is true that the human being is not yet so advanced that it can eat such vegetarian food as would guarantee him immunity to illness, but vegetarian food, even in its coarsest form, will, nevertheless, reduce the percentage of illness quite significantly and produce a quite different powerful, healthy physical well-being than the animal food, and will thus be one of the inevitable main factors on the road towards a more beautiful, purer and clearer experience of life. It is the indispensable admission card to a glorified existence. Why one boils food? A life units and B-life units. As previously mentioned, animal food constitutes an unfolding of vibration too strong for the human organism. So, in order for this food to be converted to nourishment, it must produce a surplus of energy, that is, an amount of energy that it in reality, because of its stage in evolution, has grown away from being able to supply without risk to health. So the digestion of animal food means a permanent overexertion for the human being and ultimately becomes the fundamental cause of the majority of organic illnesses. It is in order to remedy this that the boiling of food has been devised. What then really happens during boiling? In order to understand this, we must remember that all substances consist of life units, and that the step in evolution of the animal life units is too near our own on the ladder of evolution. Being assimilated as nourishment in the human organism meant therefore an unnatural death for these units. And against an unnatural death all normal life units fight. Through the assimilation of the animal life units as nourishment into the organism, this organism must take up the fight against the resistance or death throes of the life units. Only when this is finished and the small organisms of the life units are killed does actual digestion begin. But one must not believe that this digestion applies to the small killed organisms. On the contrary, these are decomposed in a quite natural way like all other corpses by a process of putrefaction. Corpses cannot be digested, but these killed organisms contain a certain percentage of those life units that are so far back in evolution that their life and well-being means being assimilated as nourishment in an organism. These cannot therefore be killed by this assimilation, but instead, by virtue of this, acquire conditions favorable to life. So we are dealing here with two forms of life unit. For practical reasons, we will call the former A life units and the latter B life units. A life units are those whose organisms are killed, and B life units are those whose organisms acquire life through assimilation as nourishment in an organism. Through the process of putrefaction of the organisms of the A life units, the B life units encapsulated within these are liberated. These are then guided in a living state by the being's digestive organs, in which they are assimilated as food, to the areas and localities in this being's organism in which they can each find their particular conditions favorable to life. The killed organisms of the A life units, on the other hand, are guided by the digestive organs out of the organism again. And it is these remains of corpses or stinking products that we know as excrement. So animal products are in reality merely indirect food, as it is only these life units that are direct food. And in order to liberate the latter life units, the former must therefore be killed. And it is a matter of course that nourishment based on this process of killing is far heavier or more difficult than nourishment where this is not needed. Here one must naturally take the individual's step in evolution into account. If we, for example, Go down to the beast of prey, we will see that the organism of such animals is to a particular degree based on and built for the promoting of the above mentioned process, but as one reaches further in evolution the organisms become more and more refined, and more lose, to a corresponding degree, their ability to promote this process. In human beings this ability is degenerating at a very rapidly increasing rate. This therefore means that as a human being develops, it becomes increasingly difficult for the process of killing to be carried out through his organism.